This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Firefighting, The Financial Crisis and Its Lessons by Ben S. Bernanke, Timothy F. Geithner, and Henry M. Paulson, Jr. Read for you by Mark Deakins. Ben S. Bernanke, currently a distinguished senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and president of the American Economic Association, was chairman of the Federal Reserve from 2006 to 2014. He is the author of The Courage to Act, A Memoir of a Crisis and Its Aftermath. Timothy F. Geithner is president of Warburg Pincus and was from 2009 to 2013 the 75th Secretary of the Treasury for President Barack Obama's first term. Formerly president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, he is the author of Stress Test, Reflections on Financial Crises. Henry M. Paulson, Jr. is founder and chairman of the Paulson Institute and served from 2006 to 2009 as the 74th Secretary of the Treasury under President George W. Bush. Formerly chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs, he is the author of On the Brink, Inside the Race to Stop the Collapse of the Global Financial System, and Dealing with China, An Insider Unmasks the New Economic Superpower. We dedicate this book to the many public servants of both parties and in both the legislative and executive branches who worked closely with us in the fight against the global financial crisis. Special thanks are due to Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama for their leadership and to the staffs of the Federal Reserve, Treasury, the FDIC, and other agencies for their creativity and hard work in the service of our country. Introduction. Epic financial infernos don't happen often. Usually, turmoil in financial markets burns itself out. Markets adjust, firms fail, and life goes on. Sometimes, financial fires get so serious that policymakers need to help put them out. They make loans when firms need liquidity, or find a safe way to wind down a troubled firm, and life goes on. It's exceedingly rare that a fire rages out of control, threatening to consume the financial system and the rest of the economy, creating extreme disruption and deprivation. It happened in the United States during the Great Depression, and then it didn't happen again for 75 years. But it happened again in 2008. The United States government, two successive presidents, Congress, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury Department, and thousands of public servants at a variety of agencies, had to confront the worst financial crisis in generations. And the three of us were in positions of responsibility: Ben S. Bernanke as chairman of the Federal Reserve, Henry M. Paulson, Jr. as Secretary of the Treasury under President George W. Bush, Timothy F. Geithner as president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York during the Bush years, and then Treasury Secretary under President Barack Obama. We helped shape the American and international response to a conflagration that choked off global credit, ravaged global finance, and plunged the American economy into the most damaging recession since the breadlines and shanty towns of the 1930s. Along with our colleagues at the Fed, Treasury, and other agencies, we fought the fire with an extraordinary barrage of emergency interventions, escalating from conventional and then unconventional loans to government rescues of major firms and government backstops for vital credit markets. When the fire kept raging, we persuaded Congress to give us even more powerful tools to fight it, including the authority to inject hundreds of billions of dollars of capital directly into private financial institutions. Working alongside an outstanding group of dedicated public officials in the United States and around the world, we eventually helped stabilize the financial system before frozen credit channels and collapsing asset values could drag the broader economy into a second depression. Even so, the economy suffered a major downturn, and unprecedented monetary and fiscal stimulus would be needed to help jumpstart the recovery. This was a classic financial panic, reminiscent of runs and crises that have afflicted finance for hundreds of years. We know from that long experience that the damage inflicted by financial panics is never limited to the financial sector, even though the strategies for stopping them require support for the financial sector. Americans who aren't bankers or investors still rely on a functioning credit system to buy cars and homes, borrow for college, and grow their businesses. Financial crises that damage the credit system can create brutal recessions that hurt ordinary families as well as financial elites. Today, much of the American public remembers the government's interventions as a bailout for Wall Street, but our goal was always to protect Main Street from the fallout of a financial collapse. The only way to contain the economic damage of a financial fire is to put it out, even though it's almost impossible to do that without helping some of the people who caused it. 10 years later, we thought it would be useful to look back at how the crisis unfolded and to consider the lessons that might help reduce the damage from future crises. All three of us have already written memoirs about our experiences, but we wanted to speak about what we did together and what we learned together, about the theory and practice of financial firefighting. We have very different backgrounds and very different personalities. We did not know one another well before the crisis, but we found ways to collaborate effectively as we worked to put out the fire, and we agree that some basic principles could apply to fighting any fire in the financial sector. Financial crises recur in part because memories fade. We're writing about this again to help convey some of the key lessons from our experience, in the hope that it will keep memories fresh and help firefighters of the future protect economies from the ravages of financial crises. Why did this crisis happen, and why was it so damaging? It was, again, a classic financial panic, a run on the financial system triggered by a crisis of confidence in mortgages. It was fueled, as crises usually are, by a credit boom, in which many families, as well as financial institutions, became dangerously overleveraged, financing themselves almost entirely with debt. The danger was heightened because so much risk had migrated to financial institutions that operated outside the constraints and protections of the traditional banking system, and because so much of the leverage was in the form of unstable, short-term financing that could vanish at the first hint of trouble. These vulnerabilities were allowed to fester by America's balkanized financial regulatory bureaucracy, a hodgepodge of agencies and authorities and regulations that for decades had failed to keep pace with changing market realities and rapid financial innovations. And one of those innovations, securitization, the mechanism Wall Street used to slice and dice mortgages into complex financial products that became ubiquitous in modern finance, helped transform panic about the risks embedded in underlying mortgages into panic about the stability of the entire system. These problems did not seem pressing during the boom, when the financial system appeared unusually stable. Conventional wisdom held that home prices would continue to rise indefinitely, and many in Wall Street, Washington, and academia believed that serious financial crises were a thing of the past. But once the housing bubble popped, fear of losses created a financial stampede as investors and creditors frantically reduced their exposure to anything and anyone associated with mortgage-backed securities, triggering fire sales where cash-starved investors are forced to sell their assets at any price, and margin calls where investors who bought assets on credit are forced to put up more cash, that in turn triggered more fire sales and margin calls. The financial panic paralyzed credit and shattered confidence in the broader economy, and the resulting job losses and foreclosures, in turn, created more panic in the financial system. A decade later, that doom loop of financial fear and economic pain has begun to recede in the public memory. But it's hard to overstate just how chaotic and frightening it was. A one-month period starting in September 2008 included the sudden nationalization of the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the largest and most surprising government intervention in financial markets since the Depression. The failure of the venerable investment bank Lehman Brothers, the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history. The collapse of the brokerage firm Merrill Lynch into the arms of Bank of America, an $85 billion government rescue of the insurer AIG to prevent an even larger bankruptcy than Lehman's. The two largest failures of federally insured banks in U.S. history, those of Washington Mutual and Wachovia. The extinction of the investment bank model that had become synonymous with modern Wall Street. The first-ever government guarantees for more than $3 trillion worth of money market funds. The backstopping of a further $1 trillion worth of commercial paper. And congressional approval, after an initial market-crushing rejection, of a $700 billion arsenal of government support for the entire financial system. This all happened during the stretch run of a presidential campaign. Vladimir Lenin supposedly said that there are some decades when nothing happens and some weeks when decades happen. That's what it felt like in the crisis. The powers of the government's crisis managers initially proved insufficient to stop the panic, in part because so many of the problems began outside the Fed's principal jurisdiction of commercial banks. But we eventually persuaded Congress to give us the authority we needed to restore confidence in the system, and the stampeders eventually did stop stampeding. At a time of intense partisanship and pervasive skepticism about government, a Republican and then a Democratic administration worked together with nonpartisan public servants and, at times, bipartisan legislative leaders to defuse the most serious threat to capitalism in generations. We are all believers in the power of free markets, and we were all reluctant to rescue reckless bankers and investors from their own mistakes. When possible, the U.S. government imposed tough terms on firms receiving aid. Sometimes, the imperative to persuade stronger institutions as well as weaker ones to participate in efforts to strengthen the system and revive confidence limited how tough the terms of the programs could be. But we knew that stepping back and letting nature take its course was not a reasonable choice. The invisible hand of capitalism can't stop a full-blown financial collapse. Only the visible hand of government can do that. And full-blown financial collapses create vicious recessions that kill businesses, limit opportunities, and frustrate dreams. In fact, the financial shocks of 2008 were by many measures greater than the shocks before the Great Depression, and so was the initial economic impact. By year's end, even after a remarkably aggressive series of financial interventions, the U.S. economy was hemorrhaging 750,000 jobs a month and shrinking at a depression-level 8% annual rate. But the economic contraction popularly known as the Great Recession was over by June 2009, and the ensuing recovery is now 10 years old and counting, an impressive turnaround compared with previous crises or other developed nations after this crisis. The U.S. stock market, labor market, and housing market have all rebounded from their depths and ascended to new heights. Experts predicted that the strategy we adopted would end in hyperinflation, economic stagnation, and fiscal ruin, and that the government's efforts to rescue floundering banks and ultimately the entire financial system would cost taxpayers trillions of dollars without fixing the underlying problems. But we were able to get the economy growing and the financial sector working again relatively quickly, and the various financial programs ended up turning a sizable profit for the U.S. taxpayer. The crisis was devastating, inflicting deep and lasting scars on individual families, the broader economy, and the American political system. But the damage would have been far worse without the concerted and powerful rescue efforts that the United States was ultimately able to mobilize. Are we safer now? The United States and the world have enacted sweeping financial reforms, which should reduce the probability of another disaster in the near future. In part, because of these reforms, financial institutions have more capital, less leverage, more liquidity, and less dependence on tenuous short-term financing. In short, our financial fire codes are stronger today. Unfortunately, prevention is never foolproof, just as no building is ever fireproof. And especially in the United States, where government interventions provoked such a strong public backlash, politicians have weakened the fire department's ability to respond to the next crisis, taking important powers away from crisis managers in the hope of avoiding future bailouts. In reality, those limitations, however well-intentioned, are likely to make the next crisis worse and the resulting economic damage more severe. The belief that legislation that purports to ban bailouts will actually prevent them in all future scenarios is a powerful but dangerous illusion. The backlash was inevitable and understandable. The government's actions to stop the panic and fix the broken financial system, although ultimately successful, did not protect millions of people from the loss of a job or a home. They did unavoidably benefit many individuals who had participated in that broken system, and some who had helped set it ablaze. Still, the next time a financial fire breaks out, America may well wish it had a better prepared firehouse and better equipped firefighters. One reason the crisis was so damaging was that the government lacked the tools needed to attack it with overwhelming force from the start. We fear that unless Washington makes significant changes, the first responders of the future will start with even fewer and even weaker tools. And just as we did, they'll have to lobby politicians to upgrade the fire department while the fire is already burning. We want America to be ready for the fire next time, to borrow a phrase from James Baldwin, because eventually the fire will come. That's why we think it's so important to try to understand the last crisis, how it started, how it spread, why it burned so hot, how we and our colleagues struggled to fight it, what worked and what didn't. We're afraid a nation that doesn't understand the lessons of this meltdown might be doomed to endure something even worse. Some of those lessons are about prediction and prevention, because the best way to minimize the damage from a financial crisis is not to have one. Most crises do follow a similar pattern, so it's possible to try to identify warning signs like excessive leverage in the financial system, especially when it's too dependent on short-term financing, particularly in corners of the system with weak fire codes and limited access to the firehouse. But it's also important to have humility about the ability of human beings to anticipate panics, because doing so requires them to anticipate the behavior of other human beings interacting in complex systems. Financial systems are inherently fragile, and financial risk tends to migrate around regulatory obstacles like a river flowing around rocks. There's no sure way to avoid a panic, because there's no sure way to avoid overconfidence or confusion. Human beings are human, which is why we think it makes sense to think about crises the way Buddhists think about death, with uncertainty about the timing and circumstances, but certainty that it will happen eventually. The crisis also gave us a lot of experience in the art and science of crisis response. As hard as it is to predict crises in advance, it's also hard to know early in a crisis whether it's just a brush fire or the start of a 5-alarm conflagration. It's usually healthy to allow failing firms to fail, and policymakers shouldn't overreact to every air pocket in the market or setback for a big bank as if it's the precursor to a catastrophe. Responding too quickly can encourage risk takers to believe they'll never face consequences for their bad bets, creating moral hazard that can promote even more irresponsible speculation and set the stage for future crises. But once it's clear that a crisis is truly systemic, underreacting is much more dangerous than overreacting. Too late creates more problems than too early, and half measures can just pour gasoline on the flames. The top priority in an epic crisis should always be to end it, even though that will likely create some moral hazard. The downsides of encouraging undisciplined risk-taking in the future, while real, pale in comparison to the downsides of allowing a systemic collapse in the present. When panic strikes, policymakers need to do everything in their power to quell it, regardless of the political ramifications, regardless of their ideological convictions, regardless of what they've said or promised in the past. The politics of financial rescues are terrible, but economic depressions are worse. We have no easy solutions for improving the politics of crisis response, But we do hope that we can help provide some context for the choices we made and update the playbook for first responders in future crises. We'll try to address some of the lingering questions about our decisions, such as why the government couldn't rescue Lehman Brothers when it did rescue AIG, and why we didn't try to break up the Wall Street megabanks after the crisis ended. We'll also discuss some other lessons of the crisis, including the importance of pairing efforts to stabilize the financial system with stimulus programs that stabilize the broader economy, and the need for government regulation of financial firms that aren't traditional commercial banks but can pose similar risks to the system. We'll talk about the challenges of decision-making in the fog of a financial war, and about how important it is to have teams of experienced and dedicated professionals in the Treasury, the Fed, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and other agencies who are willing to work cooperatively rather than competitively. We'll discuss the power and the limits of the post-crisis reforms, and how we believe they could be improved. And even though none of us is a politician, we have some things to say about the political process, which we often found depressing and frustrating, but sometimes quite inspiring. The tone for the political process is set at the top. At an extraordinarily dangerous moment in our history, Presidents Bush and Obama both had the political courage to support tremendously unpopular but critical interventions in the financial system. And while we had our share of complaints about Congress, Republican and Democratic legislative leaders came together when it counted to back the politically toxic efforts to nationalize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and then rescue the entire financial system, which turned out to be the last two major pieces of American legislation to pass with significant bipartisan support. The 2008 crisis and the painful recession that followed heavily damaged trust in public institutions. But we believe America's response to the crisis demonstrated what's possible when public officials at all levels of government work together under intense stress for the public good. We understand why many Americans don't see the government's response to the crisis as successful or even legitimate. It looked messy and inconsistent, because it often was. We were feeling our way in the dark, trying to navigate the Here Be Dragons section of the financial map. We initially followed a traditional playbook, but the modern financial system is far more complex than it used to be, so we had to do a lot of experimentation and escalation. We struggled to fight the fire with tools we didn't consider sufficient for the job, and then we struggled to persuade politicians to give us more powerful tools. And while there were no magic words we could have said to persuade the public to embrace bank bailouts or other controversial policies, we constantly struggled to communicate what we were doing and why. We hope we can do a better job of that now. The story of the crisis is a painful story, but it is in some ways a hopeful story. We believe it can also be a helpful story. Chapter 1. Dry Tender, The Roots of the Crisis. The spark for the financial fire of 2008 came from irresponsible lending in America's subprime mortgage sector. But the turmoil in that chaotic, though relatively small, corner of the credit markets could not have created a global inferno if dry tender hadn't accumulated throughout the entire financial system. The subprime meltdown was the immediate cause of the crisis, but there were deeper underlying causes that made a fragile system vulnerable to disaster. To understand the roots of the crisis, it's important to know why the spark ignited, but also to know what made the forest so flammable. And understanding the roots of this crisis is important to understanding how to reduce the likelihood and intensity of future crises. History doesn't repeat itself, but as Mark Twain supposedly said, it often rhymes. This crisis followed the pattern of epic crises of the past, mania followed by panic followed by crash, in the formulation of the economic historian Charles Kindleberger, with modern twists that made the panic even more difficult to anticipate and contain. It began, like every major crisis, with a borrowing frenzy, a credit boom during a time of overconfidence that went bust when the confidence disappeared. and the financial system reflected the overconfidence of the boom. Financial firms took on too much risky leverage. Much of that leverage was in the form of runnable short-term debt that could disappear whenever creditors got jittery. Much of the risk migrated to firms outside the traditional banking system, where regulation and supervisory oversight were inadequate and the safety net designed to protect banks in an emergency was inaccessible. And a wide range of financial institutions were too exposed to mortgages through direct and indirect channels, including the ubiquitous mortgage-backed securities that were considered safe during the housing bubble, but became toxic once the bubble popped. That helped spread investor panic, from securities backed by shoddy subprime mortgages to all mortgage securities, and then to firms believed to be exposed to those securities, and even to firms believed to be exposed to other firms exposed to those securities. Panic is contagious. These problems can seem obvious with the benefit of a decade of hindsight, but they were not widely understood at the time. While all crises begin with credit booms, not all credit booms end in crises, and the financial system seemed more stable than ever in the early years of the 21st century. 2005 was the first year without a U.S. bank failure since the Depression. The boom was masking some serious long-term economic challenges for America: rising income inequality, persistently stagnant wages, slow productivity growth, a troubling decline in labor participation for working-age men. But overall, the U.S. economy seemed in pretty good shape. There was also widespread confidence that if the economy did stumble, the financial system would be resilient. It had, after all, weathered a series of modest recessions and other tests reasonably well in the previous decades, and banks seemed to have plenty of capital to absorb losses in case of a downturn. At the time, serious economists were arguing that financial innovations like derivatives, because of their purported ability to better diversify risks, had made crises a thing of the past. But financial crises will never be a thing of the past. Long periods of stability can create overconfidence that breeds instability, as the economist Hyman Minsky famously observed. It is during these boom times, when liquidity seems limitless and asset values seem destined to keep rising, that risk-taking tends to get excessive, posing dangers that can extend well beyond the risk-takers. Before the crisis, none of us fully appreciated the vulnerabilities that were building in our financial system. But none of us ever believed financial crises were obsolete, perhaps because we had spent so much of our careers thinking about them: Ben in academia, Tim in government, and Hank in markets. As a Princeton University economics professor, Ben had been a scholar of the Great Depression, the leading historical example of financial instability sinking the economy. As a career public servant at Treasury and later the International Monetary Fund, Tim had seen the challenges in dealing with financial crises in Mexico, Asia, and around the world. And as the CEO of Goldman Sachs, Hank had lived through episodes like the collapse of the hedge fund Long-Term Capital Management and the Russian default. We had all learned how quickly overheated markets could collapse, and while none of us was as worried as we should have been, none of us thought that financial innovations and the sophistication of modern finance had immunized us against crisis. The financial system is vital to the economy, but finance, at least as it's organized in modern economies, is inherently fragile. Before we discuss the specific factors that made the system unusually vulnerable to panic a decade ago, it's worth touching on why the system is, was, and always will be vulnerable to panic. The confidence game. The basic vulnerability of the financial system stems from the fact that banks provide two important economic functions that occasionally come into conflict. They give people an easily accessible place to stash their money that provides more safety and a higher interest rate than a mattress. Then they provide loans with that money to finance riskier investments in homes, cars, and businesses that improve living standards and make economies go. In other words, they borrow short-term in order to lend long-term, a process known as maturity transformation. This can be an efficient way to allocate capital to productive uses, giving society as a whole the ability to commit resources to long-lived, illiquid investments that create prosperity and progress while still giving individual members of society access to their cash when they need it. But maturity transformation comes with some risks. Every institution that borrows short and lends long is vulnerable to a run on the bank, as in the famous scene at Bailey Brothers Building and Loan Association in It's a Wonderful Life. As Jimmy Stewart's George Bailey had to explain to the residents of Bedford Falls who were clamoring for their money, very little of the cash that depositors and other short-term creditors lend to a bank is actually kept in the bank. This can be a problem in those rare situations where creditors lose confidence in the bank and demand their money back at the same time. And in those rare situations, it's a serious problem, because most of their money has already been lent out. Even a solvent bank, with assets more valuable than its liabilities, can collapse if those assets are too illiquid to cover its creditors' immediate demands for cash. The United States, like most countries, has tried to reduce this risk with regulations that limit the risks banks are allowed to take, coupled with government-provided insurance for depositors that reduces their incentive to run if their bank seems unstable. But most banks that accept deposits still depend on other forms of funding that remain uninsured and runnable. And in the modern age, a run on a bank no longer requires a physical run to an actual bank, just a click of a mouse. This makes banks and other financial intermediaries particularly sensitive to outbreaks of fear. Prudential regulations can constrain this risk, but cannot eliminate it, not as long as banks are in the business of maturity transformation and making inherently risky loans to individuals and businesses. The more general point is that financial institutions, unlike other businesses whose success depends primarily on the cost and quality of their goods and services, are dependent on confidence. That's why the word credit comes from the Latin for belief, why we say we can bank on things we know to be true, why some financial institutions are called trusts. It's why traditional bank architecture relied so heavily on imposing granite facades and pillars to project an aura of stability and permanence in front of the fragility of finance. No financial institution can function without confidence, and confidence is evanescent. It can go at any time, for rational or irrational reasons. When it goes, it usually goes quickly, and it's hard to get back. A financial crisis is a bank run writ large, a crisis of confidence throughout the system. People get scared and want their money back, which makes the money remaining in the system less safe, which makes more people want their money back. A self-reinforcing doom loop of fear, fire sales, capital shortfalls, margin calls, and credit contractions that can produce a stampede for the exits. Once a stampede begins, it becomes rational to run to avoid getting trampled, and hesitation can be deadly. Perception and reality both matter, because runners will keep running until they're confident not only that they don't have a rational reason to run, but that others will have the confidence to stop running as well. Fear is hardwired into the human psyche, and the herd mentality is powerful, which makes stampedes hard to predict and hard to stop. The potential for panic can never be fully eradicated. In other words, the world will face the threat of financial crises as long as risk-taking and maturity transformation remain central to finance, and as long as humans remain human. Unfortunately, disaster will always be possible. So, what made this particular disaster happen? The source of the spark. The years before the crisis saw a rapid buildup of debt in the United States. Ordinary families got dangerously overextended. The ratio of household debt to GDP rose so rapidly that Tim started calling the chart he used to track it Mount Fuji. Commercial banks, investment banks, insurance companies, mortgage companies, finance companies, pension funds, and mutual funds from the United States and around the world provided this credit. What's more, they often borrowed to provide that credit, accumulating $36 trillion worth of leveraged assets financed with fragile funding. As a nation, America was living beyond its means and living off the savings of other countries. A tidal wave of foreign money was pouring into the United States as global investors, frustrated by low interest rates and scarce investment opportunities at home, looked abroad for better and safer yields. Ben called this seemingly insatiable demand for assets that generated decent returns a global savings glut, and it created a lot of dry tinder. The greatest part of the credit boom took place in the U.S. mortgage market. Mortgage debt per U.S. household soared 63% from 2001 to 2007, much faster than household incomes. Some of this new debt was beneficial, helping people buy homes or take cash out of their homes for worthy purposes. But some of the new lending veered into dangerous, unexplored territory where the underwriting standards, especially for higher-risk subprime mortgages to lower-income borrowers, eroded dramatically. Many lenders would approve almost any applicant to borrow just about the entire cost of a new home, regardless of their credit history. Whether or not they had a job, provided any documents verifying their income, or demonstrated any realistic hope of making their monthly payments. There were ninja loans for borrowers with no proof of income, job, or assets. Liar loans to folks who inflated their annual salaries or lied about their assets. Exploding arms with teaser rates that skyrocketed after 2 or 3 years. Anything to get a signature on the dotted line. Normally, lenders have strong incentives to be careful about how much they lend and to whom, because they need to get paid back to make money. But in the years before the crisis, Wall Street firms responded to the ferocious global appetite for safe-looking assets by packaging mortgages into increasingly elaborate mortgage-backed securities that they could sell to investors looking for higher returns. This investor demand gave those Wall Street firms an equally ferocious appetite for mortgages that could serve as the raw materials for these securities. And loan originators, who knew they could sell their mortgages without retaining any of the risk of default, had little incentive to seek creditworthy borrowers. Many of them even received bonuses determined by the volume of loans generated rather than their quality. These loans became grist for a lucrative mill that divided the payment streams from mortgages with different degrees of risk and then repackaged them into complex securities until the risk was sliced so fine it seemed to disappear. Of course, it did not disappear. It was just hidden and diluted and spread around the world. The originate-to-distribute mortgage model created bad incentives for mortgage originators, and some analysts have blamed it for the entire crisis. In this view, disaster could have been averted if lenders had been required to hold more of the loans they originated, because they wouldn't have been so reckless if they had more skin in the game. But the undeniable problems with that model can't tell the whole story, as many of those lenders and their parent companies did hold many of their loans, as well as securities backed by their loans, and accepted them as solid collateral in short-term lending markets. Firms like Countrywide Financial, the nation's largest and most aggressive mortgage lender, had plenty of skin in the game. They stumbled because they didn't distribute enough of the risky loans they originated. They were like drug dealers who got high on their own supply, genuinely believing that stratospheric housing prices would defy gravity indefinitely. Ultimately, the basic driver of the boom in mortgage borrowing was excessive optimism about the housing market. Rising house prices promoted easy borrowing terms, and easy terms, in turn, helped drive prices even higher. There was a widespread assumption that borrowers could buy more house than they could afford without significant risk, because if they had trouble making the payments, they could always refinance or sell at a profit. And for years, that rosy assumption was often correct. One 2014 study published in the American Economic Review found that even mortgage brokers and Wall Street bankers invested their own money in real estate throughout the boom. They were just as caught up in the mania as the buyers of their mortgage-backed securities. the executives of the venerable 150-year-old investment bank Lehman Brothers were similarly deluded, concluding a wildly misguided $22 billion purchase of the massive real estate firm Archstone Smith Trust after the bust had already begun. The mania ran broad and deep. In any event, the poor quality of many newly issued mortgages would have a major impact on the stability of the financial system. The direct losses on mortgages would have been a problem in itself, though probably a manageable one. But the securitization boom carved those mortgages into securities that became a common form of currency and collateral throughout the financial system. These securities often received AAA stamps of approval from credit ratings agencies that depended on the issuers of the securities for their fees, and markets often treated them as if they were almost as safe as treasuries. The flawed models justifying those AAA ratings depended in part on the belief that even if housing prices did slump in one region of the country, they would never crash all across the country at the same time. That had been true since World War II, partly as a result of tax policies and government programs designed to promote and expand home ownership. But the optimistic assumption that securities assembled from geographically diverse mortgages would continue to avoid the risk of mass defaults turned out to be wrong. Ultimately, home prices plunged more than 30% nationwide, and the percentage of subprime mortgages in or near default soared from 6% to more than 30%. The carnage was worst in sand states like Florida and Nevada, where the run-up in prices had been the greatest, but it was bad almost everywhere. Again, the systemic danger was not just that mortgages were less safe than they seemed. The systemic danger was that the securities they backed had come to underpin much of modern finance, which made the health of the entire financial system dependent on the perceived condition of the mortgage market in ways few people recognized at the time. That dependence would have been dangerous even if the securities had been straightforward, transparent, and traded on public exchanges. But collateralized debt obligations, CDOs squared, and other new products of financial engineering were often complex, opaque, and embedded with hidden leverage. These products were supposed to help reduce risk by spreading it around and customizing it to the needs of the investor. But in the confluence of forces at the end of the long boom in credit, they made the overall system both more vulnerable to a crisis of confidence and harder to stabilize after the crisis began. Once mortgages started to go bad and the complex securities constructed from mortgages started to seem risky, it felt easier and safer to sell them en masse than to try to figure out just how risky individual securities were. Meanwhile, the market for buying and selling derivatives, financial assets whose values were tied in complicated ways to the values of other assets, was an archaic mess of millions of contracts among thousands of private counterparties, where at times it seemed nearly impossible to figure out who held what and who owed what to whom. That meant that in a crisis, investors and creditors would be uncertain what exposures they had or what was going on with their counterparties. And uncertainty is like gasoline on the fire of panic. Still, at the time, the subprime mortgage market did not look like a threat to burn down the financial system. Subprime mortgages made up less than 1/7 of all outstanding mortgages in the United States, and the defaults and delinquencies that triggered the crisis were mostly concentrated in subprime mortgages with adjustable interest rates, which accounted for less than 1/12 of all mortgages. Straightforward calculations suggested that even if every subprime mortgage holder defaulted, the losses would be modest and easily absorbed by the capital buffers of most major banks and other creditors. What such calculations missed, what almost everyone missed, was the way mortgages were poised to become a vector of panic throughout the financial system. Kindling. When Hank left Goldman Sachs to go to Washington, D.C. in July 2006, the firm had $60 billion worth of unencumbered treasuries in a virtual lockbox, not to be used as collateral, not to be risked in trades. Goldman had learned that good times never keep rolling forever, that panics can drag down the responsible along with the reckless, and that in a crisis, liquidity is king. That was not the prevailing attitude on Wall Street in the early years of the 21st century. Financial institutions were binging on risk and leverage, borrowing heavily in short-term credit markets, especially tri-party repo and asset-backed commercial paper, to finance bets on mortgage-related assets and other forms of private credit. Some executives worried about the breakdown of risk management, but those qualms could be expensive during the boom. As Citigroup CEO Chuck Prince observed in 2007, as long as the music is playing, you've got to get up and dance. Not all bubbles threaten the stability of the broader financial system. When the dot-com bubble of the late 1990s burst, investors in busted internet stocks like Pets.com lost their money, but there wasn't much of a ripple effect, just a mild recession. The real problems emerge when bubbles are financed with borrowed money, especially when that money can run. And leverage can be alluring because it's the ultimate profit multiplier. If you spend $100 to buy an asset without leverage, then sell it for $120, your profit is 20%. But if you spend only $5 of your own money, borrow the other $95 to buy the same asset, and then sell it for the same $120, the miracle of leverage produces a 400% profit. The downside is that leverage has the same multiplying effect on losses, dramatically increasing wipeout risk. If you buy that same $100 asset with the same leverage, but the asset's value declines below $95, you've lost your entire investment. And if your creditor suddenly demands repayment of the loan or forces you to post additional collateral, you might have a real problem, especially if you don't have a lockbox full of treasuries for emergency use only. You might have to sell the asset immediately to avoid default, and if others with similar assets hold similar fire sales, the price of the assets will drop further, triggering more fire sales and margin calls and defaults, and so on down the drain. If you happen to be a financial firm, your creditors might sour on your commercial paper, stop renewing your overnight repo loans, or force you to post more collateral, the modern equivalents of bank runs. That's how panic spread after the housing bubble popped. Before the crisis of 2008, many large financial institutions were increasingly leveraged, in some cases borrowing more than $30 for every dollar of shareholder capital, affording very limited protection against losses. Increasing amounts of that leverage were in short-term debt that resembled uninsured bank deposits, the kind of runnable debt that uneasy creditors can withdraw at the first hint of danger. And many of these heavily leveraged institutions that were financing themselves with overnight credit had become so big, so interconnected, and so tightly woven into the fabric of modern finance that they would pose a danger to the system if they ever unraveled. This was all kindling that made the financial system combustible. What made the situation even more explosive and much more difficult to anticipate or head off was that many of those institutions were not technically banks. They behaved like banks, borrowing short and lending long, but they operated outside the commercial banking system, with neither the supervisory oversight nor the safety net our system provides for institutions with commercial bank charters. They faced looser or sometimes non-existent constraints on their risk-taking. They were not financed with insured deposits, and they did not have standing access to the Fed's discount window, which made emergency loans available to commercial banks whenever they were needed. Before the crisis, more than half the leverage in U.S. finance had migrated to these shadow banks or non-banks, investment banks like Bear Stearns and Lehman, the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, insurance companies like AIG, money market funds, corporate finance arms like GE Capital and GMAC, and even non-bank affiliates of traditional commercial banks. These firms all engaged in the fragile alchemy of maturity transformation, but without the security of insured deposits that never run, without effective regulatory constraints on their leverage, and without the ability to turn to the Fed if their financing evaporated. This lack of oversight over non-banks was particularly dangerous, but the entire U.S. financial regulatory system was creaky and fragmented, a set of overlapping bureaucracies with tribal rivalries. While commercial banks had the most formal oversight, the responsibilities for supervising them were divided among the Fed, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, OCC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, the Office of Thrift Supervision, OTS, foreign regulators who helped oversee U.S. affiliates of overseas banks, and various state banking commissions of varying levels of vigilance and competence. In some cases, banks effectively got to choose their own supervisors by changing their legal form. Countrywide reorganized itself as a thrift in order to enjoy the notoriously lenient oversight of the OTS, and often had multiple supervisors with unclear lines of authority. Outside the commercial banks, oversight was even less stringent. The mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, known as government-sponsored enterprises, or GSEs, had their own mostly ineffectual Washington regulator. The Securities and Exchange Commission oversaw investment banks, but did not try to constrain their leverage or limit their reliance on short-term funding. The SEC mostly focused on investor protection, as did the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, whose purview included many derivatives markets. The Federal Trade Commission, the Fed, and a slew of other federal and state agencies had various financial consumer protection responsibilities, but it wasn't anyone's top priority. Another critical gap was that none of these agencies was responsible for analyzing or protecting against systemic risk. There was no single regulator responsible for safeguarding or even monitoring the safety and soundness of the system as a whole, rather than the safety and soundness of individual institutions. There wasn't a single supervisor who had visibility into the entire system of non-banks and banks. Nobody was assessing the general safety of derivatives or overnight funding or other potential threats to stability that cut across institutional or regulatory lines. And while the FDIC had emergency authority to wind down failing commercial banks in a swift and orderly fashion, no one had the authority to step in to avoid a chaotic bankruptcy of a major non-bank during a crisis. We were all uncomfortable about this, and all three of us established new risk committees and task forces within our institutions before the crisis to try to focus attention on systemic threats. We tried to lean against the prevailing winds of overconfidence, pushing back against the notion that crises were vestiges of the past, calling for more robust risk management and humility about tail risks. But we were not sufficiently creative or forceful in acting to contain those risks, and none of us recognized how they were about to spiral out of control. For all our crisis experience, we still failed to anticipate the worst crisis of our lifetimes. When Ben was later asked what surprised him most about the crisis, he replied, "The crisis." For all our concern about government's inability to ensure the safety and soundness of our messy and complex system, we did not think it was on the edge of panic. We were worried something terrible could happen, but even in the months leading up to it, we didn't foresee how the scenario would unfold. For example, we and most others did not expect short-term wholesale funding to run, because much of that funding was collateralized, providing protection for investors in case of default. We did not anticipate that in panic conditions, investors would not consider even high-quality collateral, which they would have been forced to sell quickly in a rapidly deteriorating market, to be an adequate guarantee. These failures of anticipation were in part a failure of imagination, and in part a failure of institutional organization within the government. There was no overarching agency with responsibility and accountability for monitoring or addressing systemic risk. The patchwork regulatory system was so fragmented that much of what was happening was out of the sight of supervisors or seen as somebody else's problem. And this crisis was particularly difficult to anticipate because it was the result of not just one or two evident factors, but of a host of complex interactions among many evolving trends. the explosion of financial leverage, the reliance on runnable short-term funding, the migration of risk to the shadow banking system, the rise of too-big-to-fail institutions, and the ubiquity of murky derivatives backed by shoddy mortgages. Each of these factors would play an independent role in what unfolded, but their rolling interactions created a particularly dangerous panic. Of course, we were not alone in our failures. The crisis caught just about everyone by surprise. One lesson for crisis detection is that it's incredibly hard to predict a financial meltdown. Some people might be prescient about some things, but you can't count on prescience as a realistic crisis avoidance strategy. It's hard to fix something before it breaks. The financial system is inherently fragile, but policymakers, including legislators, can make the system more or less fragile. With the benefit of hindsight, it's clear that the government failed to rein in the excesses that would help spark the crisis. It is now evident, for example, that the government let major financial institutions take on too much risky leverage without insisting that they retain enough capital, the flip side of leverage. The more an institution relies on borrowing, the lower its capital levels, and the greater its exposure to shocks. Capital is the shock absorber that can help an institution withstand losses, retain confidence, and remain solvent during a crisis, and in retrospect, America's financial institutions needed a lot more of it. But that's in retrospect. At the time, banks were easily exceeding their legally mandated capital requirements, and regulators didn't think they could demand that they raise more. The New York Fed did ask the banks it oversaw to run stress tests modeling the potential impact of recessions and other types of shocks, but times had been so good for so long that they couldn't even imagine dark outcomes. Not one bank came up with a scenario that significantly dented its capital buffer. This is the downside of a long period of calm. It can lead to complacency. It would later become clear that the backward-looking capital regime for banks, designed to protect against the kinds of losses created by relatively mild recent recessions, was not conservative enough. Regulators allowed banks to count too much poor-quality capital toward their required ratios, rather than insisting on loss-absorbing common equity. And supervisors failed to recognize how much leverage banks had hidden in complex derivatives and off-balance sheet vehicles, which made them look better capitalized than they actually were. This was not usually the result of intentional deception by banks. Frequently, the banks themselves were unable to assess the full extent of their exposure to risks. And most bankers were as overconfident as their clients about risks in the housing market. But while the existing capital regime for commercial banks was too weak, it was nonetheless strong enough to drive trillions of dollars worth of leverage into the non-banks that weren't bound by it. Stricter scrutiny of bank capital levels, or for that matter, bank liquidity levels or bank reliance on short-term funding, could have driven even more leverage into the undercapitalized shadow banking system outside the jurisdiction of regulators and the reach of the Fed's safety net. Risk, like love, tends to find a way. That's the paradox and the inherent danger of a fragmented regulatory system that sets different standards for institutions that call themselves banks and for institutions that get described by some other name. The most vulnerable firms in this crisis were technically not banks, although they shared many aspects of the bank's business model. And the most damaging problem with America's capital rules was not that they were too weak, but that they were applied too narrowly. The institutions with the most reckless mortgage-related investments and the least stable funding bases also had the thinnest capital buffers, but they were operating largely outside the reach of the regulatory system. Ideally, there should have been a stronger and more comprehensive regulatory system, as well as tougher and more proactive regulators. But during the boom, there wasn't much political appetite for stronger financial regulation of any kind. The FDIC's annual report for 2003 included a photo of federal regulators and bank lobbyists taking chainsaws and pruning shears to red tape, reflecting the era's dismissive attitudes about bureaucrats meddling with markets. And if the prevailing mood was inhospitable to stricter enforcement of existing regulations focused on banks, it was downright hostile to reforms modernizing those regulations or extending them to non-banks. The financial industry, flush with profits, defended its prerogatives by pouring more money than ever.